The Bible has remarkably few illusions about human nature. In the book of Ecclesiastes, we read, "There is no man so righteous that he sinneth not." And we have the two similar texts in the book of Genesis. The thoughts of a man's heart are impulsive from his youth, and sin croucheth at the door. From the denunciation of Israel's spiritual leaders, we know that ancient Judea could claim, for better or worse, a full number of the denizens of the underworld and of the selfish world. They had their share of the monopolists, of those who have a mania to pile power upon power. Isaiah described them as those who join house to house and field to field till there be no more room in the land. Ancient Israel had its alcoholics, those who rose up early in the morning to follow strong drink, and who tarried late in the night till wine inflamed them. Israel had those who sold to the poor things which they could not afford at exorbitant prices and interest rates. Jeremiah described these hucksters of poverty as those who prey as fowlers lie in wait, who set a trap for the poor and catch men. Therefore have they become great and waxen rich. Nor do we have a monopoly on the Christine Keelers and the Elizabeth Taylors. In the Bible we read, in the twilight, in the evening of the day, in the blackness of the night and the darkness, and behold, there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot and wily of heart. She caught him and she kissed him, and with an impudent face she said to him, "Come, let us take our fill of love, for my husband is not at home. He is gone on a long trip." Immorality is not a 20th century invention. There is very little reason for original research in the whole area of sin. Modern man cannot even claim that he has pioneered in the area of the sins of suburbia, the sins of indulgence and of affluence. Kohelet here was the pioneer 3,000 and more years ago. "I searched my heart to pamper my flesh with wine, the cocktail party. I built my houses, first in the city of Cleveland, then in the Heights, then in Gates Mills. I made my gardens and parks, one larger and more expansive and expensive than another. I acquired men servants and maid servants, first a cook, then a parlor maid, then a butler. I gathered in also silver and gold and treasures such as kings have claimed to, first a Ford, then a Cadillac, then a Rolls Royce. I got me men singers and women singers, television and hi-fi, and the delights of women, very many. Whatsoever the heart desired, I kept not from it." Sin is an archaeological science, not an experimental one. There are no undiscovered sins. And how I wish I could teach this to the young who are bursting with the urge for freedom, and tell me that they want to pioneer new accommodations, new ways of life which will be freer and more open to them, to mankind. Free love has been tried. The mescaline drugs have been tried. Every variety and vulgarity of human behavior has been tried and tried and tried again and has been found wanting. Morality was not devised by men as a trap for other men, as so much of our thinking seems to indicate. It was devised by men because without it, there is no family, there is no civilization, there can be no happiness. Without continence, there can be no stability in the marriage relationship. Without restraint, there can be no companionship, no growth in the depth of love. Without the decencies which exist neighbor to neighbor, there can be no society, no stability, no security, no civilization. Morality was devised by men because without it, there can be no civilization. Those who abandon morality should at least have the decency to admit that they are not pioneering some new and better way of life. All that they are really doing is re-exploring the ancient, the tried, and the found wanting. As Kohelet said after he experienced all the indulgences of suburbia, I searched my heart, and I found that all that I had wrought was a striving after the winds and a vanity, a snare and a delusion. Now I cite these evidences of ancient immoralities because I have no basic sympathy with the rash of head shaking which has been going on of late about what is alternately called our breakdown in morality, or as Look magazine had it, our crisis of immorality. And we are not a nation of saints, far from it. But I keep asking myself, when was it other? Was it better a generation ago? Was a generation of the hip flask and the speakeasy, of Teapot Dome and of the Chicago gangster murders, and of the sneering by the sophisticates of the Mencken Fitzgerald School, was that generation a better generation? Was it better two generations ago? Was a generation of the robber barons, of child labor and the sweatshop, and of Newport indulgence, was this a better generation? I doubt it. In terms of morality, there are no good old days. It may seem so to us. We may have been protected and isolated by our homes in some quiet backwash of a suburb in the city. But take the civilization as a whole. And there was as much callousness and cruelty and indulgence then as now. One generation ago, two generations ago, 10, 100. Men have shown the same strengths and the same weaknesses, the same wisdom and the same folly for far too long now. I find little comfort in this historical romanticizing, in the shaking of the head and the pointing the finger and the throwing up the hands at statistics, all to the point that somehow we are not the men, we lack the moral fiber that someone else had. Perhaps we do. But if we take the historical view, the society as a whole does not. Indeed, I would like to suggest to you this morning a skeleton of ideas which may help us to view rather more intelligently the strengths and the weaknesses, the perversions and the achievements of modern society, and which, if we understand it, may help us to redirect some of the sources of energy of our society to our mutual benefit. I would like to suggest to you, first off, that morality is a byproduct of religion, that it is no happenstance that the first law at Sinai was, I am the Lord thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. The Ten Commandments and the rest of the Bible flow instinctively, inevitably, from this belief in the one kind, just God and Father. Now, America is a nation of many denominations. There are many religions in America, but there is one which is supreme, and that is the faith in America itself. I mean by this not the flag waving nor the 4th of July, but the imprint which American ideals, constitutionally compacted, impress upon each and every one of us, whatever be our racial or national background or origin. Americanism, the faith which is America, has its roots in our Bible. But it has not emphasized equally all the virtues which one finds in the Bible. Indeed, it has made two supreme: the virtue of social justice and the virtue of freedom. Establish ye justice in the gates, proclaim ye freedom unto the land, unto all the inhabitants thereof. These biblical ideals were congruent with the basic energy and hope of the American founders, and they have remained elemental in the mainstream of American life. And it's precisely in the area of justice and of freedom that America has made its greatest achievements and can point with pride to its highest level of moral behavior. In most other modern nations of the world, human welfare is the unique prerogative of the state. In America, it is an eager partnership between citizen and state. Our public schools are run locally and taxed and financed with local funds. We have in our city a widely ramified program of assistance agencies, social welfare agencies, vocational guidance agencies, and the like, which are financed by both government and private citizen, and receive, as we have seen magnificently in the past week, the united support of a united community. America has, since its beginning, been determined that our society shall be an open one, that the ancient indignities of caste and of class which stratify men into the position of their birth, that these indignities shall be erased, that we shall give to each his opportunity to rise in our society as far as his native talents and disciplined skills can enable him. Now, this has not been achieved eagerly, nor has it been fully achieved. Privilege rarely gives up its prerogatives voluntarily. There are always those who cry out against the giving of the rights to the masses. But such has been our determination that we have seen through the hypocrisy, the specious logic of those who claim special advantage, and we have denied it to them. They said to us, look at the rabble. And the rabble might have been the foreigner, the immigrant, the Mexican worker, the Negro, the Jew, the Catholic, the Irish, the Italian. Look at the rabble. They are shiftless. They lack the common courtesies. They will not work. How can you think them to be equal to the responsibilities of freedom? And America has answered. Give them the opportunity. Give them the training. Give them equal justice in fact as well as in law. And you will find that they are equal to whatever responsibilities you put upon them. Integrate a class of children, Negro children, into a white school in Washington. And it is true. You will find that their grades are lower than those of their white fellow students the first year and the second. But improve the quality of their homes. Give jobs to their parents. Give food into their mouths. Take them off the city streets. Integrate them into equal classrooms. And in a year, two, three, five, you will find that they are producing and even perhaps outproducing. When Moses took the children of Israel out of Egypt, he found them a motley rabble. The Bible calls it an erev rav, semi-literate, emotionally depraved by the cruelties of Egyptian slavery, men who at the first challenge of the desert cried out, return us to the flesh pots of Egypt, men who were, in a very real sense, unfit for the responsibilities of freedom. There is always a transition generation, a generation of stress and of strain. But America has, as did the ancient Jews, persisted, fought through, and established a plateau of opportunity for all. which gave all the opportunity to be moral. The great stress of our current life is our attempt to complete the work which our ancestors began. The Negro is the last major element of our population, which is michutz la-machaneh, outside the camp, quarantined, pushed out of the mainstream of American life. But we should not see a Birmingham riot or an Oxford, Mississippi riot as elements in the immemorial drama of human cruelty, but rather as elements in the American drama which says, you may not eternally have the indulgence of your prejudice. They are the last statement, the death throes of ancient injustice, and not another example of the age-old cruelty of man to man. America's social conscience, then, has been of a high order. Our social morality has been fine and refined, unique in the world. And I would remind you of that, and we can take great pride in it. When South Africa was faced with a similar tension, they architected the abased cruelty of apartheid. When after the Second World War, England, from which we took so many of our institutions and ideals, was faced with a steady influx of Negroes from the colonies, her answer was to shut off the traditional free flow of in-migration. For all of our falterings and our fumblings, for all of our detours and our delays, we at least put our shoulder to the grindstone and said, this cannot last eternally. We will achieve a solution. We are determined. We will not look away from the problem till it be solved. This is the legacy, the moral legacy of our American way of life. But if this American way of life has given to us the high degree of social morality, if it has led us to insist that everyone be given the opportunity to be moral, it has not been equally successful in teaching us what are the moral obligations of the free. Once you have reached this plateau, what are your moral responsibilities to your country, to your city, to your family, to your wife, to your parents, to your business or profession, and to yourself? And here again, to understand why the immoralities of America tend to be the private indulgences. We spend too much, we play too much, we smoke too much, we drink too much, we indulge ourselves too much. Why it is in this private sector of morality that we fail and stumble, I would ask you again to return to seek an understanding of this American way of thought. It is emphasized, I have said, justice and freedom, but supremely the ideal of justice, of freedom. Our nation began in revolution. And there is a 200-year history of suspicion of all government, and all authority, and of all restraint. We were compacted by the Declaration of Independence. And independence, free thought, the right to make our own mistakes, the right to make up our own mind, is elemental in the American character. We set our children in school to reading Emerson's essay on self-reliance. We teach to our children the motto, you know, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. We tell them to make up their own minds, and we insist on this far more than we do on their obedience to our authority. When they write, we are not so concerned with their spelling and with their punctuation as with their free expression. Our art, our music, our architecture, every aspect of American life evidences this emphasis on rugged independence. Its extremes can be seen in Greenwich Village and in Greenwich, Connecticut. In those who deny the social moralities and those who deny the right of government to interfere in their private financial operations. There is an instinctive distrust of discipline, of authority, of regulation. and an implicit trust in the right of man to be himself, to lead his own life, to manage his own destiny, to be responsible only to his own conscience. Now, independence is a strong and heroic virtue. And politically, it has permitted us to go far. Socially, it has allowed us to experiment and engineer in our society new deals and fair deals, necessary social change. But privately, it is a debilitating philosophy. Freedom, absolute independence, rugged, untrammeled individualism is a denial of morality, of responsibility. Responsibility means to be responsive to care about, to limit yourselves in favor of, love thy neighbor as thyself. Morality begins when we admit that we cannot even be born without the aid of another person. Morality begins when we admit the ties of family, the obligation to return kindness for kindness, service for service. Morality begins when we recognize that a relationship of love must have a relationship of sacrifice, that each cannot follow blindly his own concerns and his own career without returning and building up and knitting and serving and caring and being tender towards. Now, this emphasis on independence is, in my estimation, the basic reason why we have been so indulgent with ourselves, with our appetites and our greeds and our lusts. It has weakened each and every one of the elemental relationships of men. Men walk about, women too, feeling that their first responsibility is to themselves. You hear it. I have only one life. Why should I bind myself to this back-breaking routine? I have only one life. Why should I bind myself to this marriage which fails to give me a full range of satisfaction? I have only one life. Why should I spend my time away from my home, away from my interests, away from my hobbies, in the service of my community? I have only one life. Why need I bow to the conventions of manner or of dress set by others? I have only one life. I insist, I demand on the right to lead it. But can you lead a life apart? Can we be alone? What would our freedom be if we were not protected by others? What would be our schooling if we were not educated by others? Where would be our healing if we were not cared for by others? Where would be our growing if we were not counseled and protected by parents? How could there be love if another was not willing to invest herself or himself in us and in our future? Man has more loves than one. Man lives an interdependent life. For such a life to be good and lasting and moral, he must admit that this interdependence circumscribes his right to be free and untrammeled, the maker of his own destiny, the master of his own fate. He has obligations to his parents, and his parents to him. You know, growing old in America is a sad and lonely thing. Sad because children are encouraged to institutionalize, to push the parent out, and sadder yet, because so devastating is the impact of our American culture upon the aged that they consider it a virtue not to accept the hospitality of the home, not to accept the invitation of the child. Far better, they say, to go their way alone. What of marriage? A partnership of love and of sacrifice. How can there be a lasting marriage if each person walks his way in life with the first consideration being the fulfillment of what he believes his own talents. Must all such arrangements, such partnerships, not be an adjustment? And must there not be primary responsibilities and those of second rank? Must there not be fulfillments which can be had now and those which must be postponed? What are the relationships of parents and children? I wonder sometimes at all of us who are parents. We are so fearful to discipline, so fearful to punish, so fearful to give advice. We have always before us that psychological bugaboo that somehow we're going to tie our children so closely to us with such strong silken cords that they will never be men, never be able to go their own way. Well, if this skeleton of ideas which I am presenting to you has any merit, they ought never to go solely their own way. They ought always to know that they live within a network of obligations, within a community, and that the basic communal obligation remains that which our Talmud teaches us. Al tifrosh min hatzibur. Whatever you do in life, do not ultimately scissor yourself away from the community. Apart from your family, apart from your marriage, apart from your friends, apart from your community, you are as nothing. Furthermore, you may have all the dignity, all the self-respect, all the rights to your own opinion and to your own mind within the community that you can have without it. And if you are wise and strong, you can be as successful and as determined. Our rabbis taught this, and with this I close. Our rabbis taught this truth through the wording of a simple prayer. It was a prayer that they recommended to the solitary traveler on an open road. If as night fell and he became concerned that he might be attacked by wild animals or by marauding robbers, let him say, the rabbi said, "May it be thy will, O Lord, to lead us in safety." To lead us in safety. Though he was one, let him pray in the plural. For he is not one. He is the traveler alone on the road, to be sure. But he is also the father. On the success of which, of this journey, the substance of his home depends. He is the husband, loved and dependent upon. He is the father whose counsel is needed. He is the member of a community whose intelligence and strength is required. He is a member of a craft guild, which produces a necessary item of commodity. Man is not one, never so. Man is always many. And if we can only restructure into our American way of life this elemental truth that we live within the web of the community, not above it, or outside of it, or beyond it, independence is a virtue only so long as we admit the equal validity of interdependence. Then I think so many of these moral questions which concern us will find their own solution. For men will not be tempted to indulge themselves, to be self-concerned. And it is that temptation which I would submit is the basic vice and weakness of our way of life. Amen.